I knew of Pelé being the greatest player on the planet well before I started covering soccer. I think I was in high school. I heard about him winning World Cups, and I said, well, that's pretty amazing.
That was Michael Lewis. And this is Founding Football. Like so many kids in America, particularly in the 80s and 90s, I played soccer growing up, but I wasn't a fan. Sure, I was aware, at least loosely, of the great names playing in a televised World Cup when it came around, and that meant names like Maradona and later Zidane, Beckham and Ronaldo, the original one. They would make their way over the televised airwaves and into my ears. And that was about as far as it went. Pelé was no longer playing at this point. His legend was well established, and I'm sure stories were published about him and features still ran on TV. But I don't remember them. This was the 90s, cable was just beginning to grow, the internet didn't make content immediately available to me. So there was a premium put on currency. What are the current stories that matter? And sure, sometimes historical context was woven into those narratives, but I wasn't hearing Pelé's name, jumping onto my phone and Googling him to learn his life story. So I wasn't finding thousands of resources and hundreds of YouTube highlight packages. I didn't know anything about him. It's no wonder then that in a soccer-devoid upbringing, Pelé wasn't terribly familiar to me. What is surprising is the first time I remember hearing his name. It came out of my grandmother's mouth. Sometime, I think, during a Summer Olympics or World Cup one summer day when we were together at her beach house on the south shore of Long Island. I can't for the life of me remember why. I was just a kid, but I can guess. See, my grandmother was not a soccer fan. She was born in France and immigrated to America as a young teenager, then developed an affinity eventually for baseball. If you listened to previous episodes, you'll know my grandparents honeymooned at a Yankees game. Yeah, that was her. And see, that's where I imagine her understanding of Pelé came from. She was an America fan, a New York fan, a connoisseur of culture. She was in love with Rolls-Royce and, according to her, was the only member of the Rolls-Royce Club of America that didn't actually own a Rolls-Royce. French culture and New York culture, those were her specialties, and they came together in one of her primary business ventures, a successful French restaurant, Le Champignon, on West 56th Street, Manhattan, that was open in 1968 and went on to thrive well into the early 80s. I was young. So my memories of eating at that restaurant include the best chocolate mousse I ever tasted. And that's about it. For those that better remember the restaurant, it was an upscale and outstanding establishment. My grandmother hosted the cultural elite at her restaurant in the 70s and 80s. In New York City at that time, that meant glamour and celebrity. Names like the Ramones and Iggy Pop, Woody Allen and Studio 54, Donald Trump and his emerging real estate empire, LL Cool J teaming up with Rick Rubin to mold hip-hop. Those were the things that the patrons at her restaurant were talking about. That was New York City, and her restaurant was right in the middle of it. Nestled in between those cultural milestones was Pelé and his stint with the Cosmos from 1975 through 1977. I'd love to tell you that Pelé ate at my grandmother's restaurant. He may or may not have. I never asked and I will never have the chance to, but she knew who he was. And not because she knew about soccer, but rather because she had her finger on the cultural pulse of New York City. Pelé, during his unexpected stint in New York, was a global superstar transplanted into America's biggest city. He wasn't just a soccer icon, he was a cultural icon, which meant he fit right in. He seamlessly became a star about town, and if not a patron at her restaurant, a topic of conversation at the tables within it. Pelé transcended soccer and instantly wove himself into the cultural fabric of the most culturally dense city in the world. So much so that a female French immigrant running a restaurant in Manhattan, saw him as part of New York and also part of American iconography. That was the Pelé effect. His charisma and cultural relevance was so profound that he simply walked into New York City in the mid-70s and ascended to the top of its collective consciousness. In doing so, he brought soccer with him, putting a Times Square-sized spotlight on the world's most popular game and elevating its profile in America. That my grandmother knew Pelé, whether he ate at her restaurant or not, is why we've selected his time with the cosmos as Chapter 5 in Founding Football. The story of soccer can't be told without a chapter on Pelé. Many chapters, really. The story of soccer's popularity in America, then, certainly can't be told without a chapter on Pelé. The fact that he was part of this story is amazing in its own right. It's transformative in both its magnitude and its timing. There are two key components to the Pelé story: his influence on the North American Soccer League, and the presence of the man himself. After the soccer war of 1929, America was devoid of a true top-flight professional league. The North American Soccer League reignited hope that America could support that type of league, that it would grow, and that it would stimulate popularity of the game in our country. The reality is, without Pelé, or another star to anchor the league, those hopes were likely dashed, or maybe, at best, unsatisfactory. But that star, that anchor, that was Pelé, the greatest player that ever lived in the minds of so many. He transformed the way people watched and described the game. He influenced the future generations that played the game. His artistry simply made people fall in love with the game. Of course, like with so many things, we have worked hard to Americanize him. I even struggle to say his name in any other way than the most Americanized version that comes out of my mouth first. But you hear it so many ways. Whether it's Pelé or Pelé or Pelé, we made him our own in every way. We took his name, we pronounced it in an American way, and we owned it. If the 1950 World Cup game made us believe that we could, at some point, compete on a global level, and the 1959 NCAA Championship showed us a path to develop talent at home, Pelé playing on our soil gave us a 3-year period to measure the progress on both fronts. It's obvious to make Pelé part of any soccer story, but it's important to understand that he was the right man at the right time for one of the most evasive tasks in sports history, making America really and truly fall in love with soccer. Pelé didn't need New York. In fact, before he came to New York, he had what would have easily been called, at the time and maybe still, the greatest soccer career in the history of the game. In fact, he was comfortable with his achievements at his childhood and lifelong club Santos, as well as his achievements on the world stage when he retired in 1975. If you're listening to this show, there's a good chance you are well aware of Pelé's exploits. But they're so incredible, it's worth revisiting them, if only to wonder, as you listen to this list of achievements, why he was motivated to play in America, and also how important it was that he was the right man to come and play here at the right time. You'll excuse me because my pronunciation of Brazilian names and places is not the best, but I'm going to try. Pelé was born Edson Arantes do Nascimento in Brazil in 1940 to a footballing father, Dandinho. It's not the connection to America that we'll focus on, but Edson was named after Thomas Edison. They took the I out, but that was the intent. Pelé is a nickname given to him during his school days, one he claimed had no specific meaning, or at least he didn't know the origin of it. Along with the parents and two younger siblings, Pelé grew up poor in Sao Paulo. So poor, in fact, that he couldn't afford a football and played with a stuffed sock or a grapefruit but he found his way to a handful of youth teams, and he led those youth teams to a number of championships. He also played futsal when it was first ascending to competitive heights in Brazil, winning championships in those competitions as well, even though he said futsal was difficult. And then in the end, he credits the game to helping evolve his technical skills. He played against older competition during futsal, and he worked in tight spaces and learned problem solving. He joined the club Santos as a professional in June of 1956 at the age of 15, after his youth coach took him to a tryout. Pelé arrived with hype and made his senior team debut by September of the same year, scoring his first goal on the same day. Again, he was 15 years old. The following season at 16, he moved into the starting 11 and became the top scorer in the league. That same year, he made his national team debut for Brazil. In both cases, it was the start of something incredible. For Santos, he became the club's all-time leading goal scorer with 643 goals in 659 games. In a golden era for Santos, he led the club to the 1962 and 1963 Copa Libertadores and to the 1962 and 1963 Intercontinental Cup. Incredibly, he stayed there during the prime of his career, fending off interest from the biggest clubs in the world. That included Real Madrid and Manchester United. Even if he wanted to leave, it became absolutely impossible. The Brazilian fans worshipped him, and the government declared him a national treasure in 1961, urging Santos to turn away any mutual interest established between Pelé and the European elite. On the international level, his resume is no less decorated. He made his national team debut at 16 years, 9 months old, also in 1958, against Argentina. The Brazilian national team won 2-1, and he scored his first goal in his first cap. He is still the youngest goal scorer in the history of the Brazilian national team. And then the following year, at 17 years old, Pelé became the youngest player to play in a World Cup final, when he and Brazil made their way to Sweden for the 1958 affair. It almost didn't happen, see, he arrived injured, but upon his return to the lineup, he immediately showed his quality. He scored a hat trick against France in the semifinal, then at 17 years and 249 days old, he scored twice in the final against Sweden on June 29, 1958. Brazil defeated the Swedes 5-2 in that game, and the prodigal son won his first World Cup with his country. He was nicknamed the King following the 1958 tournament, and Pelé then won two additional FIFA World Cups in 1962 and 70, bringing his total to three. Though he was injured early in the 62 World Cup, Pelé scored six goals en route to the qualifying for the 1970 World Cup, then won the Golden Ball en route to his third victory in the tournament. With 77 goals in 92 games for Brazil, Pelé held the record as the national team's top goal scorer for over 50 years until Neymar recently surpassed his total. He was majestic. The origin of the phrase "the beautiful game" is associated with his style of play. Pelé was larger than life and a revered sportsman off the field. He defined what greatness in soccer looked like. As Pelé was winding down his career with his final national team game coming in 1971, the North American Soccer League was emerging as the first true top-flight professional league in America since the Soccer War of 1929 essentially brought down the American Soccer League. You could argue that this project should have an episode on the NASL, but I would argue that the history of the North American Soccer League is really defined before, during, and after Pelé. And the reality is that before Pelé, the league had moderate success, and after him, it died. There are other reasons, of course, but he is a big reason. The unexpectedly high television ratings for the 1966 World Cup prompted some enterprising businessmen to think that professional soccer could thrive again in the United States. Two professional leagues were born quickly thereafter. The United States Soccer Association was founded in 1966, and the National Professional Soccer Association came to be in 1967. They then merged in December, They then merged in December of 1967 to form the NASL. The new league launched in 1968 with 17 teams. Five of the 22 teams that came from the merger, they were redundant in the various cities, and then they folded. The new league launched in 1968 with 17 teams. Five of the 22 teams that came from the two separate leagues were redundant in various cities and folded. Despite being an American soccer league, the rosters were stacked with international talent. There were only 30 American players rostered among the 17 teams in the league. There were some wins in that model. For example, the great Brazilian Vavá, who was one of the leading scorers of the 1958 and 1962 World Cups, he joined the San Diego Toros, giving the league immediate name brand recognition. The quality of those athletes gave the NASL enough fuel to schedule international friendlies against Pelé Santos and against English champions Manchester City. But the model also had immediate challenges. The wage scale was high, and salary costs plus stadium rentals and low gate revenue meant that every team in the league lost money in that inaugural season. CBS pulled its television deal, and the league was already in dire straits. All but five teams had to fold. The league wanted to survive. It needed to survive to keep any sense of forward progress alive in America. So it got creative. Two existing franchises from the second iteration of the long-running American Soccer League, the same one that in all its glory had been shuttered after the Soccer War of 1929, they were invited to join the NASL. Those teams were the Rochester Lancers and the Washington Darts. And despite the ASL's classification as a semi-pro league, Rochester and Washington were the most successful teams in the league the year they joined, with the Lancers beating the Darts in the final. That move was enough to create forward progress, and in 1971, the league expanded again. Three new teams joined the fold, the New York Cosmos, the Montreal Olympique, and the Toronto Metros. The price of entry was a $25,000 expansion fee. And now with a larger pool of teams and a sense for what was working, the league made some rule changes in an effort to align more closely with other spectator sport experiences in America, in an effort to gain even more fan support. Simple ideas were implemented, such as counting down from a 90-minute mark rather than the traditional approach of counting up to 90 minutes. Offside rules were modified. Penalty shootout rules were modified as well. Everything was done in the spirit of making the league a higher scoring affair. And it came together. The mainstream media started paying attention to the sport again. Sports Illustrated ran a cover story on the Philadelphia Adams goalkeeper Bob Rigsby in 1973. That was the same year the Adams, as an expansion team, won the NASL title. It was the first time an American professional expansion team won a league title in its first year. But that may not have been the biggest victory of the Adams. Two other elements of the story were at play. One, the team's average of 11,500 fans in 1973 was the first time a North American Soccer League team averaged more than 10,000 fans in a season since 1967. The second thing was that they started six Americans on their championship team. For a sport seeking commercial approval, this was an important step. They were filling seats and doing it with a roster of American players. Attendance had grown from a low of 2,930 in 1969 to 7,770 in 1974, with four teams averaging over 10,000 by that year. CBS was back in the fold, televising championship games between the Los Angeles Aztecs and the Miami Toros live that year. It was the first pro soccer broadcast since 1968, and history was about to repeat itself. The growth created maybe too much optimism, and just like it had at its founding in 1967, the league expanded quickly and leaned back into importing foreign talent. Eight new teams joined after that benchmark 74 season, with two existing teams folding as well, so the league increased by a net of six teams. Some of that expansion was out west. Cities like Seattle and Vancouver joined the fray. Then in 1975, five more franchises came on board, and the league surpassed its original charter of 17 teams, now boasting 20. 1975 also brought back the appetite to add names from other professional soccer leagues. This would sharpen two edges of the same sword because the finances of the league would soon get ugly, but it also brought Pelé to New York. Clive Toy was the New York Cosmos general manager and a man with a vision. He believed the team, actually he believed the league, needed star power to succeed. They were in New York after all, and it was something he believed early on in the NASL's fight to stay relevant. With that as his mantra, Toy had one goal, to sign Pelé. In fact, he and league commissioner Ian Woosnam brainstormed the idea after that initial league contraction to five teams in 1969. That move also forced the league offices into the basement of Atlanta's Fulton County Stadium, apparently where they had this idea. It wasn't at the time as simple as sending an email to Pelé's agent. Toy had to find and meet him and talk to the man about his idea, so he began showing up anywhere in the world he knew Pelé would be. And that approach took him to Jamaica and Rome and Belgium. This started happening in the early 70s and some of those encounters as early as 1971. This was the same time that Real Madrid and Juventus were chasing Pelé's signature as well, though it had been hard to pry him away from Santos previously. It was clear he had no shortage of suitors. Initially, Pelé said no to Toy, but he wasn't deterred, and he felt he could offer the legend something no one else could, a way to bolster his legacy. Toy's pitch was simple. Pelé could win a championship with those clubs, but he could win an entire country with the Cosmos. And after all of those pitches, Pelé retired. After 19 seasons with Santos in 1974, he was done playing for his lifelong club, and by all accounts, not planning to lace up his boots again. But Pelé, in need of money, finally gave in. He came out of retirement, and the North American Soccer League and Cosmos got their man for $1.67 million per year and for 3 years. To say he had an immediate impact would be an understatement. Within weeks, and certainly by the end of his 3 years, he proved that soccer not only could survive, but also thrive in America. It was true from the moment he signed his contract at the 21 Club on June 10th, 1975, in front of a mass of ecstatic worldwide media. It was true 5 days later when 10 million people tuned into his debut match against the Dallas Tornado in Downing Stadium on Randall's Island. It was true when he scored in that game, helping the Cosmos to a 2-2 draw. For 3 years that followed, Pelé quite simply captivated the imagination of America and opened its eyes. Even past his prime, coming out of retirement, Pelé dazzled on the field. He had 37 goals in just 64 games and led the Cosmos to the 1977 Soccer Bowl in his third and final season with the club. In June of that year, the Cosmos posted a 3-0 victory past the Tampa Bay Rowdies, with a 37-year-old Pelé scoring a hat trick in the final. But it wasn't just the result. It was the context around that playoff run. That final, that game, drew 62,394 fans to Giant Stadium. It wasn't even the largest crowd during the run to the championship. In the first leg of the quarterfinals, they attracted a U.S. record of 77,891 for what turned into an 8-3 rout of the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, again at Giant Stadium. He was a ticket-selling machine. The Cosmos drew upwards of 40,000 fans per night at their height. He brought eyeballs to TV as well. In addition to Pelé's debut, CBS also televised another Cosmos match, plus the 1975 Soccer Bowl championship match, and in 1976, ABC signed a contract to broadcast matches during the 1976 season. By that year, the NASL was picked up by a mainstream media, with sports pages and newspapers covering the league. Their games were shown on syndicated television services during 1977 and 1978. It was succeeding. People were buying tickets to soccer games. They were watching soccer on TV. America was, on some level, a soccer country because of Pelé. In the end, There was only one Pelé, though, and the NASL had to learn that the hard way. His success was transformational for the league, but it was transformational around him. They just didn't realize it until it was too late. The owners believe they had a model for success, bring in big name foreign players, and the fans will come. The Cosmos, for example, added Franz Beckenbauer to their roster. Though past his prime, Beckenbauer was one of the best defensive players in the world, a starter for Germany, and he joined Pelé to make the Cosmos formidable, to make them champions. And other big names entered the league as well. Los Angeles Aztecs signed Manchester United star George Best in 1976. In 1977, Los Angeles signed Johan Cruyff, who helped double the team's attendance almost immediately. Cruyff also won the league's MVP award. The league just kept adding names and wage costs. But there were two problems here. The cost of the league was increasing, while the image was mixed. Yes, Pelé and Cruyff and other big-name international players brought eyes to the game and patrons to some stadiums. But many teams in the league struggled to sell tickets and were still rostering mostly international players, players that were well-known overseas but didn't have the same cachet in the U.S., that Cruyff and Pelé had. So this wasn't a sustainable model, and it wasn't entirely well received because while these expensive players were occupying budget, they still weren't rostering enough American players. Even though the league had built a college draft in 1972 to increase the number of US and Canadian-born players, they were still scarce on the rosters. After the 1977 season, team owners voted to mandate an increase in the number of North American players by limiting the number of non-North American players a team was permitted to have on the field at one time and reducing the total of non-citizens on a club's roster to 11 by 1984. With the end of the 70s, the NASL seemed poised for moderate success. The 1979 season had seen attendance increase by 8%. ABC televised several matches during the 79 and 80 seasons. But there were challenges under the surface with Pelé gone. They'd soon bubble up over expansion and those high wages and the impacts of recession and the negativity around a lack of North American players. They all began to pile up. The league ran a collective deficit in 1980 of about $30 million. The 1981 season was even worse for the league, with the league's 24 teams again running a collective deficit of $30 million, which is $82.2 million in 2022. And every team was losing money. The decline was steep thereafter. The league lasted until the 1984 season, with only nine teams taking the field. On March 28, 1985, the North American Soccer League suspended operations for the 1985 season. And we'll dig a bit more into the tail end of the NASL in a later episode, but for now, it's important to know the league believed that Pelé had shown them a model of big names, but that also meant big money, and it simply wasn't sustainable. So it was, sadly, that the impact of Pelé could largely be seen by what we had given the NASL and then what was lost after his departure. Even still, the success that came with his time in the league was unmistakable and a template for eras to come. Here to share more about his personal experiences with Pelé, our guest on Founding Football is soccer writer Michael Lewis. Author of Alive and Kicking, The Incredible But True Story, the Rochester Lancers, and eight other soccer books, editor and founder of frontrowsoccer.com, which is, I think, where you can find him most frequently at this point. Former publisher of Soccer Week, has writing credits, including a long stint at the New York Daily News. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on, Kent. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, this should be a fun conversation because I think you have a unique perspective on one of the great stories in American soccer history. There are a number of different topics that I'm exploring in this project, trying to understand how we got to a point where I firmly believe soccer is part of the American fabric now. Safe to say that, in the mid-70s, that wasn't true. And so as we talk about your direct knowledge and coverage of the greatest player in many people's minds of all time, we can talk about the Messi fans and maybe have that debate later. I'd love to learn from you about Pelé.
Well, what do you want to know? even before I knew of Pelé being the greatest player on the planet.
Yeah.
Well before I started covering soccer, I think it was in high school. I heard about him winning World Cups, and I said, "Well, that's pretty amazing." Although I could care less about soccer at the time, it was baseball, football, hockey, basketball. But you had to appreciate someone like that who not only could perform magic on the field, but what a personality that he'd be willing to just go travel around the world, be a goodwill ambassador. Maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I've seen him enough through the years where his people had to push him away from autograph seekers. There comes a time when he's got to leave. And it was incredible. And he would talk to people. And I know when he first joined the Cosmos, his English might not have been the greatest, but he learned the language. He knew, if I'm not mistaken, 5 or 6 languages. And we're talking, obviously, native Portuguese, Spanish, Italian, English, and would not be surprised if German and maybe another language, and French too. Wouldn't be surprised if there was another language thrown in there. And just always a gracious and humble person, someone who had so much talent, but his ego was somewhere else. And I admired him from afar. I never thought I'd have an opportunity to talk to him one-on-one and get that close to him and watch him play and see him perform his magic live.
I think you have really succinctly summarized some of the reasons he captured America's imagination, but lay out really what the extent of your coverage was of that time he spent with the Cosmos.
Well, I should go back and let you know that it was 1975. I was just completing midway through my first year. I was 22 years old, and it was a winter night in Rochester. I'm sorry if I'm going to go into ultra detail here.
That's good.
Bill Parker, assistant editor of the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, called me over, and he had a high stack of papers and files on his desk, and he starts talking to me about soccer and the Rochester Lancers, and I knew exactly where this was going, and I said, "This isn't good at all. Please wake me up from this nightmare. Please, someone." And here I am, first year, I was covering high schools. Apparently they liked the job I was doing, but they wanted to see, okay, what can I do with a professional team? And I understand soccer at the time was nowhere near what it is today, but obviously it was a good way to find out a lot about a writer, whether he or she could perform under a different type of deadline and context. Anyway, by the end of Bill Parker's talk or soliloquy, he pushed the pile of files toward me and congratulations, you're covering your first professional team. And all I wanted to do was push the files back and say, thank you, but no thank you. Hey, we had a year probation at the time, my first job, you're not going to give up your first job. And I should let you know, I was making $9,000 a year, which back in 1975 was a big deal back in Rochester, New York, or even anywhere. Trust me, money went a long way back then, but I took it, and it was a great way. It was a gateway for me to learn about the world. You know, the Lancers, even though they were a headache off the field at times, some great players, great personalities from Ghana, Nigeria, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, even the United States, and that's probably a topic for another time about the Americanization of the game too. But I just wanted to give you a little background about how begrudgingly I accepted the assignment. Saying that, a few months later, Pelé signs with the North American Soccer League, well, with the New York Cosmos, and I'm thinking, this could be interesting. The Lancers play in the same division as the Cosmos, and they play them twice a year at home. Unfortunately, he hadn't signed with the team yet the first time the teams met in Rochester, but the second time they did. And here I am, June of, 1975, 23 years old. I'm in a press conference. And it's, you know, this isn't New York City where you've got a ton of radio stations and a ton of newspapers there. We have two newspapers and TV and radio stations. But I got a chance to ask him a few questions in the press conference, which, you know, I can't say I was innocent, but I was a young sports writer. And I said, hey, this is pretty cool. And this was a day or two beforehand. And he, I believe it was translated by Professor Mazet, which is fine because I know his Pelé's English at that time was not the greatest. A day or two later, he plays for the Cosmos. Cosmos beat the Lancers 3-0. He scores his first NASL goal. And again, fantastic. And obviously, what am I going to do? I've got to run to the Cosmos locker room afterwards and get a comment out of him. And I get a chance to talk to him one-on-one. Well, maybe it's one-on-one-on-one because I have to go through Professor Mazet, which is fine. Got a couple of great quotes from him as well, too, for my story, because that was the bigger story. It wasn't that the Lancers lost to the Cosmos. It was Pelé scored a goal, his first official NASL goal for the Cosmos, in his, I think his second game. So that was the bigger story. And, you know, I should let you know, Hollander Stadium, the home of the Lancers, sat 18,000 people. I think they had about 15,000 people for the game. It was a big deal. It was their biggest attendance up until then. So it was a very, very big deal in Rochester, obviously. And that was, I guess, my first days, the first time with Pelé. Little did I know that I was going to be, I can't say following him, but writing about his exploits, some of it as a player, but a lot of it even after he hung up his soccer boots.
There's a funny bit of symbolism that I'm smiling about that I'll just point out, because you referenced the Americanization of soccer, and this entire project is about how we came to love soccer in this country. And I think a lot of that is about creating distinctly owned moments. And you, of course, understand and respect the global game. So you're appropriately respecting the name and the pronunciation of Pelé. And you laughed earlier when I said Pelé, which is, of course, the American pronunciation of the name. And we do that kind of stuff. But I actually think that's an important segue into one of the questions I want to ask. We're going to get to his personality, his play on the field, but so much of his decision to join the NASL was about being convinced that he could bring the beautiful game to America. How big a piece of this story is the idea that Pelé could make America love soccer? How big a part of his decision do you believe that ultimately was?
I think that had, I can't give you a percentage, obviously, but I think it's got to be a huge part, because he had conquered the world except for America. Think of it. Yeah. He was a member of 3 championship World Cup teams over 4 cycles, which is pretty stunning for anyone. I don't think the U.S. women have done that, and they've been pretty darn
pretty good.
Pretty darn excellent, I should say. But, you're talking about, a special player who had done everything. He had made a lot of money. And yes, there's been talk about maybe his business manager or some unscrupulous people there made sure he didn't make a lot of money as well, too. And I think this was an opportunity to, turn essentially a soccer wasteland into something that meant something. I think everyone realized at the time, and you've got to give a lot of credit, maybe all the credit, to Clive Toy, the general manager and president of the Cosmos, for being relentless, and you could almost say ruthless in the best way possible, of not giving up, because the journey for him to sign Pelé took many meetings, thousands of miles over several continents, and I don't know if I had the wherewithal to do something like that. And I could be relentless too, but nothing like that. But I think Pelé was convinced after a while, after he probably had to learn about American soccer, American sports, what the personality of the United States was about. and he said, "Hey, you know something? This is a legacy I could have in a country outside of Brazil. I mean, in Brazil, he was like a god.
A god.
I can't say like a god. He was a god.
Still.
Yes, and he will ever, forever will be, and rightfully so. Yes, money plays a factor. You know, you're not going to do anything for free like that. And the trajectory turned out to be incredible. I've got a strange feeling we're going to be talking about that in a few minutes, but I look at Pelé deciding to play in the United States for the New York Cosmos as a big bang moment in U.S. soccer. There are other parts of it too, but you know that was the first big bang moment, because after that, well, before that, soccer was considered an ethnic sport in this country. But all of a sudden, soccer came to suburbia. All of a sudden, we had youth soccer leagues around the country. It was basic soccer. There was nothing. We were still in the learning stages, but it started a soccer boom, which we're still feeling today, and we're probably going to feel for a long time, maybe forever. And I think that was Big Bang 1. Big Bang 2 was the Paul Caligiuri goal in 1989, let me get it right.
1989.
That boosted the U.S. into the 1990 World Cup. And then I think it was the advent of the U.S. women's team winning the 1991 World Cup and then taking off from there. There was it took more than just that moment, but I think the U.S. women dominating for so many years that put the sport into a different orbit. But I know we'll go back to Pelé, but I just wanted to put things into perspective.
That's okay, Michael, because I think you're making one of the key points, because certainly leading up to Pelé's joining the Cosmos in the NASL, there weren't that many moments that I think you could say created a shift in momentum around maybe a broader ubiquity of soccer, as you say, outside of ethnic or immigrant neighborhoods, because that was a big part of the story, certainly in soccer's first golden age, and then after it sort of faded post-soccer war. Why do you think someone like Clive Toy, and then there were reports that Henry Kissinger got involved in the recruiting efforts, why were there some individuals that believed at the time it was important that soccer, for all intents and purposes, become more mainstream? What was the driver? And maybe it was simply personal love for the game, but do you think there were other factors at play that really made those individuals believe it was so critical?
We were left out of the world in this game. Yeah. Every country in the world, or just about every country in the world, played this game at a certain level, maybe not at a high level like in England, Italy, Spain, France, or Brazil, or Argentina. I better say Argentina, or my Argentine friends will be PO'd at me. And we weren't even close to the brass ring at all. We had a lot of soccer lovers in this country. When I say, people who were willing to pay for small sums of money because they just enjoyed playing the game and they excelled at it. But there was something missing internationally. And I think maybe I'm not trying to create a controversy, but maybe the U.S. didn't get maybe as much respect because we didn't play the world's game. And I think maybe it was important for us to participate in it at a decent level. I'm not saying win it. I know winning the World Cup, that's probably another a podcast you could worry about in the future, but just to be competitive at it and to have players playing overseas, playing in the United States, having a viable league. And I think just, I can't get into the political end of it, but it certainly doesn't hurt when maybe whoever the president of the United States is, and maybe he's visiting Germany, maybe she will be visiting Germany, and remind them that, hey, we just beat your team in international soccer, just as a little jibe here or there. But I think it was just important to join the rest of the world in this sport. I mean, because we had these four major sports, plus plenty of individual sports too, you know, tennis and golf and bowling, among others. But we just, it was about time we did that at a certain level. And it wasn't just having a small domestic league. It was having a viable domestic league. Well,
yeah. Well. And I think you're onto something there. You say you don't want to get into the politics, but there is a lot to be said for the idea of a decade, the 70s, where international diplomacy was at a heightened state, had a lot of attention from the media. And you're right. We didn't necessarily have this connection that the rest of the world had to each other. I think that's incredible insight. And yet what we did then would bring Pelé to the NASL is a distinctly American concept. We have our own league, but we want it to be the best. So maybe we'll break that sort of isolationist mindset and import the greatest product that can be had into something that is also ours and create our own moment. In many respects, that's the identity of this country historically. But that doesn't work if it's not the right person. Someone who is captivating, who has charisma, who can bring something beyond just gameplay into the equation. So what was it about Pelé's personality that made him the appropriate person to take on this opportunity and challenge?
You know, he's such a humble person. I mean, he does have an ego, but he probably hides it, or it was in the way he played. I use the word magic because I think that describes a lot of what he was as a player and off the field as well, too. And the fact that he could talk or speak in a number of languages, maybe not well in English early on, but the fact that people saw that he was trying to learn it was a big deal. And just there was just something about him, an aura around him. And being that humble person, I think he enjoyed the spotlight. He didn't maybe necessarily live it, but when he was doing autographs to groups of people, he could stand there forever. I called him in one of my stories, probably in more than one story, the most patient man in the universe, because he would talk to people. He was, whether he was signing a picture, a postcard, a piece of paper, but he would talk to the kids or the adults. And, you know, at least back then, you didn't see it that often. Today, we don't see it as much. Now, you're getting charged $15 per autograph for a player, that sort of thing. And, you know, his people, whether it was his bodyguards or his manager or whatever, they had to take him away from the crowd. And, you know, how many athletes do that in general? And I had, you know, it's one thing you might say, oh, well, you saw him do it once. No, I saw this happen several times. And I said, this is incredible. I don't know if I would have the patience to do that. And it's not like I would say, I don't care about you, but it's like there comes a time to leave. But I think he understood the value of talking to the youngest person there and maybe to the president of a country. They all were we're on the same level to him.
And they all mattered.
Yes, they all mattered, yes. And, you know, just when he ran onto the field, the way he strutted, ran or whatever, waved to the crowd, little things like that, I think people enjoyed that. And, you know, just a special person in so many ways.
So he understood the need. He understood the challenge, trying to bring this game into the forefront of America's consciousness. He had the personality, but he still had to perform on the field. Otherwise, it doesn't have the same impact. And you referenced this earlier as a young, intrepid reporter getting to cover the cosmos and seeing him score in his second game. It's an interesting scenario because for all of the accolades at the time, Brazil's all-time leading scorer, more goals than anyone could count, though, of course, we counted them at Santos. He had ultimately retired, and he was in the twilight of his career. Mm-hmm. I don't think there were questions that he would do something or some things miraculous in his time in the cosmos, but talk about how he did perform, how he did captivate people's imaginations, even at this advanced stage in his career. Because I think in some respects, that's as impressive as the personality and just the fact that he even came here.
You have to remember he had retired from professional soccer. Yep. So there is a, you know, you've got to get back into a certain shape. And, you know, 1975, people might not realize this, and this is sort of like Messi joining Inter Miami CF. Cosmos didn't make the playoffs because they just got off to a real mediocre start, and they just did not have the players around Pelé to boost the team to a different level. Then eventually, what we know is soccer is not a one-man or one-woman show. And so the Cosmos put some incredible players around him. When we're talking about Franz Beckenbauer, Carlos Alberto, Pelé's teammate from the Brazilian national team, the great Giorgio Canalia, and another set of players that might not have been as known to the U.S. public from an international basis, but still some really damn good players. And essentially they had what people called like an all-star team, and Pelé thrived under that, especially in 1976, even though the Cosmos missed out on the brass ring, the NASL championship. They were still a fun team to watch. And I think the first half of 1977, when the Cosmos moved into Giant Stadium, playing on artificial turf, and Pelé, I don't think it played on artificial turf too much, but he was dynamite the first half. The second half of the season, unfortunately, I think his age was starting to catch up with him. I think, what was it, like 37 years old?
Yep.
He didn't seem to be the same Pelé that we expected. He could still perform magic here or there, but it became Canalia's team offensively. Saying that, he never changed as a person. But at least in 1977, the King went out on top. The Cosmos won the North American Soccer League Championship at Soccer Bowl in Portland, Oregon, beating the Seattle Sounders 2-1. I happened to be at the game, and it was a surreal moment in the locker room afterwards, because usually most American journalists are, pretty professional. We don't cheer. We try not to cheer. We're not supposed to, no cheering in the press box. There was the Brazilian media chanting Pelé's name. They hoisted him on his shoulders and they paraded him around the locker room. I had never seen anything like that before. I mean, I wish I had a cell phone at the time. I would have taken a video of it because it was amazing. And I would like to think someone's got to have video of it somewhere. I had never seen anything like that before. And I'll never forget the words in a cluster of media, Pelé, knowing what he had accomplished, because at that time, soccer in the United States had grown. There have been youth clubs and teams for 3 years now. He said, I can die now, because he knew he had accomplished it.
How did you see people's receptivity to the sport change over those few years? How do you think the country viewed soccer through the lens of his time with the Cosmos?
It definitely changed the perception. As someone who didn't want to cover soccer, who by the middle of 1977, I was comfortable with the game, and I wanted to see the sport, not just survive, but thrive, okay, from my part. I know the human condition is we want to have things immediately. And I know NASL started to expand, and that we could get into that, or that's another couple of hours of a podcast you could do as well too. But there was an acceptance, and people wanted maybe revolution, and I understand things. No, it's evolution. Things just don't happen overnight. Saying that, the sport went from not having a soccer ball in a commercial to, I think, a Campbell's soup commercial, kids playing soccer and then having soup afterwards for a snack or meal or whatever. And then slowly but surely, it was getting into the American consciousness on the field, but also off the field too. Culturally, that was obvious. That was going to be that an important next step as well too. There were still a lot of soccer non-believers, haters. People still were calling it a communist sport and whatnot. And a different maybe generation of writers or media people who didn't understand the game. Heck, like I said, I didn't understand the game when I first started. But I think slowly but surely it was being accepted. I think the leaders of the North American Soccer League, particularly Phil Woosnam, wanted that revolution. It takes a long time to do that. It takes, you know, it doesn't take years. It could take decades. And where we are now with MLS, we still have a ways to go. But look at the strides we have made since then.
Well, Michael, I think you just did a beautiful job articulating why I'm taking on this project. And you talked about the impact downstream of other people. Look at me. I quit playing soccer at 13. I decided to play baseball in the fall because fall baseball was an option at that point. Mm-hmm. I never really understood the depth and breadth of this game globally because it wasn't something that I was exposed to, because history is written about what was, not what is almost, as you well know, unless you are better educated. But then my daughter picks up the game. She falls in love with the game. I study the game. And yeah, I agree with you. I think you said it perfectly. History is connected. And I'm so happy you just really talked about it that way, because that's the purpose of this entire project. So a great way to say thank you for joining this episode. You're right. You touched on a lot of things that I'll also be exploring, because, you know, the interconnectedness of these moments that have really gotten us to a point where I think we can now safely and happily say soccer is part of our fabric. That's pretty cool.
Thank you very much for the kind words, and thank you very much for having me on. I've enjoyed it. I think some of the questions you made me think, not that I'm not thinking, but maybe things that I didn't think of before or that were hidden in the brain somewhere in my noggin up there. Thank you.
Awesome. Michael Lewis, well-known soccer writer, author of Alive and Kicking, The Incredible But True Story of the Rochester Lancers, and 8 other soccer books. Editor and founder of FrontRowSoccer.com, which is where you can find him most frequently at this point. Former publisher of Soccer Week, has writing credits, including a long stint at the New York Daily News. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. Pelé's legacy is unquestioned, his place in the soccer landscape indelibly etched into any and all historic records. But his contribution to soccer's growth in America simply can't be understated. As we've discussed in our season so far, the sports-obsessed society in this country simply had resistance to soccer on a large scale. Throughout the 50s and 60s, soccer had its own small moments that began to extract it from the immigrant and ethnic communities and deliver mainstream stories. None of those moments, none of those stories, however, gave it the means of mass media consumption that would put the sport in the conscious minds of the public. None of them brought the gravity required to help soccer take the necessary step forward as a place of consumerism or passionate consumption. The 1950 World Cup game showed us we could compete on the world stage with American players. The 1959 NCAA championship gave us a model for attaching soccer to the rapid growth of higher education, one that could continue development of our players at scale. Title IX opened those same higher education doors to women, and the founding of U.S. youth soccer helped rapidly scale the availability and legitimacy of the youth game. All of these moments were about opportunity and infrastructure to play at varying levels. None really were about testing and then capturing the spirit of soccer fandom at any scale, casual to crazy, until Pelé came to America. Sure, the North American Soccer League showed enough incremental growth that we believe professional soccer could be viable at some level in the ranks of American sport before he got here. but the craze and media sensationalism that surrounded the greatest soccer player putting on his boots and performing on American soil for 3 years, even past his prime, pulled out of retirement, it proved that given the right ingredients, this country could be pulled into the passion that surrounds the beautiful game globally, that we could become part of the ecosystem of football that connects fans in Argentina with rivals in Brazil, or that delivers drama share between citizens of Barcelona with their distant neighbors in Paris. Pelé proved that we could love the game to the level of selling out Giant Stadium many times. We could turn on appointment television in the tens of millions for a soccer game. He showed us that a professional league in America, given the right balance of foreign talent injection and sustainable business practices, a balance that was reached briefly in the NASL, could work if done correctly and given a chance. MLS, Beckham, now Messi. The reality is those events were made possible because of Pelé. Those models were built off his time with the Cosmos in the 70s. Everything that made Pelé a national treasure in Brazil was still present when he came out of retirement and laced up his boots in New York. Pelé left an impression on the game, the people, the sporting consciousness of America. If our first four chapters were about credibility, infrastructure, and momentum, Pelé was about passion, proof of interest, a clear sign that we, American sports fans, could and would carve out a place for soccer if the ingredients were right. Thank you for listening to Chapter 5 of Founding Football, Pelé Comes to New York. I'm your host, Kent Malmrose. This episode features original music by Hayden Malmrose. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review Founding Football. For more information or show notes, visit our website at foundingfootball.com. We'll be back next week with Chapter 6, ESPN, Indoor Soccer, and the Highlight Culture. We'll see you then.